Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. Once again, we are here looking at the language, checking out the techniques, giving you some, I don't know, some weapons against the weapons, in theory. Dr. Dan French, I am an American rhetorician, also late night comedy writer, stand-up. I try to teach the people, entertain the people, whatever the people want. We'll see where we get to. The podcast does three things. We talk to comedians. I talk to the right because I want to convert them. And I talk to academics and persuasion professionals. And once again, we are back with Dr. Dave Payne in the rhetorician interviews. This is like number 20, I think, or 22. Or
who's counting?
Who's counting? Doesn't really matter. And we've been talking about the war lately, but I think today we're going to switch a little bit and we're going to talk about the confirmation process for the Supreme Court that's going on, because it is such a really interesting location for so many rhetorical issues that pop up. So right now,
I did have one war tidbit. I don't know if you want, we want to come back to it later.
Hit a little war. Why not? I mean, the war is there. Like, it's not.
These are two faces of the same consciousness. Right?
Really? It is.
I made a mental pin in that one of the commentators this morning on about the war said, well, Putin is immune to rhetoric. And I thought,
nice.
Your sort of playthrough question is, well, what can we do? Right? What can rhetoricians do? And the declaration here that basically at this point, there is nothing to be said that's going to alter anything. No form of persuasion will work except for military action. And I thought that's an interesting cusp to be on. Right.
Yeah, when people abandon the effectiveness of persuasion.
No, this could be why we're sort of rendered mute at this moment.
Well, that's what everybody ends up doing, right? They end up moving, like whenever you start the big conversations, the big theoretical conversations of rhetoric, like rhetoric determines reality because there's no way to get around language for human beings. Everybody wants to just take that and move it over into a side, you know, whatever, that just sounds weird to me. And they go right back to doing the same modeling of reality that they always do.
Right.
So I've run into this a lot. I remember Sociology Dave, when I was at USF, the first time he ran into language theory, language reality theory, and just completely offended by the idea that there are no ways around language. And I'm like, go ahead, try.
Well, yeah, I suppose it is at kind of that cusp that, I mean, it's about framing. To what extent, no specific act or verbal act determines the reality, but yet what we consider reality is sort of the accrual of symbolic acts over time. So it's kind of a question of framing. So whereas no specific verbal act in this putatively, this is, I guess, to translate the claim, whether it's true or not is another issue. But there is nothing to be said in the current context that would change anything for Putin in terms of his objectives and what he's doing. However, the arriving at this point was all done through talk.
Right. I mean, it's the idea that he's absorbed so much rhetoric of his own that he's chosen and now so steeped in this idea of the Russian Empire and himself as a powerful dictator and authoritarian that he won't accept any new language coming in, any new persuasion coming in.
Well, that there has to be a frame breakage here at some point, right? That is, once again, a conversion downward to war, rather than a conversion upward to some sort of transcendence, right? So,
well, and it's also the explanation of it becomes pretty quickly, this person can no longer rationally process. you know, they're beyond rational process. They're somehow insane, or they, you know, all the different abnormal psych diagnoses that you can throw on these people. Ergo, you still can't use language or persuasion with them.
Right. Well, there is a kind of a hardening of the categories, and those kinds of things are becoming much, you know, what we were talking about last week are becoming much more rigid and calcified, in the sense that, okay, we can identify basically Putin has three options. One is to just sort of say, oops, and quit. And that ain't going to happen, according to those in the know. Secondly, he can stop and declare victory, keeping whatever he's conquered right now, and say, well, that's really what I wanted all along.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished, right. And that seems to be the only one that we're kind of sort of baiting for him. That seems to be the frame we don't want to break. And then third is to go escalate, right? And the kind of the intensity of Bogomaki, right? The war of words on each side of each of those options seems to be increasing. Maybe nuclear war isn't such a bad option.
Right. I saw that today that the new nukes allow it to be contained. So it doesn't.
Why should we wait on him? Why shouldn't we? There's in a sense of sort of the ratcheting up that somehow the stalemate. But I think, you know, I don't really want to get into all of the rhetoric creates reality kind of talk, I guess, or to try to parse that out. But seems to me that we framed it those particular kinds of ways.
Well, rhetoric has, I mean, in the toolbox, it has reality effectors, clearly. Like, it's one of the things that we try to do, that you can get somebody to a stable, even a holistic worldview. And I guess that's what they're talking about with Putin, that, you know, he's either created a worldview and now it's so coherent that he doesn't want to break it. But it's still untrue, right? Like, anybody can, if you could get to him, if we could get rhetoric to him, if we could smart missile rhetoric into Putin's, you know, inner circle or something, there are people still influencing him. It doesn't look like it from the outside, but he's still taking advice from generals. He's still taking advice from, you know, other people. The oligarchs, you know, the mystical oligarchs who circle around him, clearly somebody in there has, you know, they've got to have some kind of input on Putin.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, we only know what these people who allegedly truck in that stuff tell us. And that is one conversation that is going on, which is, really only a very few people, and they're completely afraid to oppose him. I guess the other voice in that you hear is, eventually he will listen to the population. So I think that's kind of the binary thing. Someone was saying, well, hey, if the mothers get enough body bags, you don't want to mess with Russian mothers. They've collectivized before.
Well, that's the fourth frame that I would add into the three Putin options. The fourth one that we really do want is the unsettling of the Russian culture and society, and it acts back to usurp Putin, you know, and then we get some type of sea change within Russia.
That's what we're hoping for, but seems to me that and his symbolic act that answers this is that giant rally, right? I don't know whether he's wearing body armor under all of that.
Well, and you've mentioned history before, becoming more interested in sort of comparing the now to historical epics when things similar have happened. And I was reading something this past week where somebody was saying, you know, in the 1900s or whatever, Russia was an imperial power that was immune to, you know, Western democracy. And guess what? Russia is still an imperial power that's immune to Western democratic ideas. And so, like, when you look at it in that terms, that fourth frame, it's going to take a lot more work than, hey, we just hope that they get tired of standing in lines and not having their cell phones working.
Right.
Like, how do you reset an imperium? you know, an imperium culture that's been that way for hundreds, if not thousands of years?
I certainly don't know. I certainly don't know what possible forces there are in the Russian culture. And we don't know what Putin's investments are. You know, he could be, in the way some commentators structure it, he could be at this sort of trap between zero and one. If I don't manage to pull this off, I'm gone.
Right.
This is my swan song here. And
this is one of the worst situations for rhetoricians, that we don't understand the target. You know, like we can't get persuasion into Russia. We can't get it into Putin. And we also don't understand the target anyway, so we wouldn't know what to say. So it's this blind rhetorical strategy that you're really seeing when I look at the news and the media. You know, I told you before we started, I don't process things in real time because I just can't handle the way that, you know, it's presented. I come back in the second wave or when they're starting to clip it. But when I look at the way they're presenting it, we're just doing it blindly. Like, it's whatever comes up. Like this, I think today it was hypersonic missiles became the meme that popped up. Hey, they're using hypersonic missiles. And then it's like, what's that? So like all the explainer videos and.
Right.
So it's a confusing war. And for rhetoricians, that's really not the way we like to play the game. Like, you like a really strong study of the target so that you can craft your messages so that you're fairly confident they'll have the effects you want. And that's just not the
game. Well, I think about it as a contraction of meanings. There's no plays in systems. So rather than say rhetoric creates reality, there is a sense in what is and what can be real, right? Made real to an audience. And there is, so I guess this feeds over into the disinformation thing, there is no particular new information or new truths. Nothing's going to be trusted that will alter how we've anchored ourselves in the current set of definitions, basically.
Yeah, I look
but
at
this is one like kind that. Of, this is a war for, right, of this sort or another, and the West is the same way. It seems to me that we've quieted even a lot of the dissenters on this side. That would be the one new thing to report, maybe, is that the pro-Putin commentators are more marginalized and having to backtrack more than before. Is this thing, well, in a way, I mean, if your goal is to unify us all on one page and move us to action from a rhetorical point of view, that's a good thing. But if your goal is to leave enough play in the system that we can create new options, new meanings, that's not particularly a good thing.
Well, this is the one of the sub areas that I find really fascinating when you start talking about war, because that's the highest stakes we've got, you know, and they keep raising the stakes, world war and extended war, and he's going to go into Poland. And so the stakes are clearly very high in this rhetorical situation. And so the reaction is to super control the rhetoric, like to repress any alternative that seems like it's doing anything positive for the enemy. You know, even right. Like the idea that if we start doing propaganda techniques on the good people side of, you know, creating caricatures of the enemy, like you see all the World War II and World War I American propaganda against, you know, Germany. And you're like, wow, we're going to allow that because the stakes are so high that we can't even, curb our own propaganda, you know, to keep it rational. So like that idea of repressing all the Putin, pro-Putin people, it's a wartime rhetoric move, right?
And it's a standard groupthink move. I think Janice called them self-appointed mind guards to make sure that to police the information and the countervailing points of view. So silencing the cynics, ridiculing the opponents, vilifying them in some way or another. So those are all sort of protective interpretations.
Well, it's to not get in the way
of certifying that we are right, we are moral, we are good, and we're powerful.
Right. But it's this weird, and you see this, I think it's very important right now with the right-left stuff in politics, that you have the good dissent, right? Like the, you know, the history of civil disobedience by low-power groups. And then all of a sudden, the right comes along and starts grabbing these same techniques where you have false dissent or, you know, problematic dissent, like the truckers who are blocking things up, just try to stop, I don't know, vaccinations or whatever.
Right.
And so, you know, this kind of mixing now of the moral and immoral techniques with the different groups. And I see this, like what you're saying, in war, like there are good dissenters even in war. Right. Like, hey, we need to really think about this, not just, you know, platitude our way through this war, versus there are people like Tucker Carlson who are using this to stoke ratings and say, you know, maybe Putin's not bad, you know, but they're both the same thing. They're both dissent from the center. But you have to somehow relabel those to allow one and fight the other. How do you do that?
Yeah, no, I agree. On the other, you know, so at some point we need some kind of criteria, right? In other words, that's the euphemism of information versus disinformation. One wonders, why are we calling it disinformation as a strategy? Yeah. Okay, it's myth, it's lie, it's whatever the spectrum is, I suppose that's kind of the clinical value of it, is just to say, okay, this just simply is not true. I mean, this is based on faulty facts.
But disinformation itself, using that word information within the negative, gives it a credibility that it shouldn't have.
Sure. You know,
there's no middle term of neutral information and then correct information and incorrect information.
That's right. In that kind of binary of certain or uncertain, right? And that's the problem there. The domain where rhetoric prospers can probably do humanistic goods is in these contingent truths where we really don't know. It's not about information or factuality, right? We don't know what counts as information. And I think we do arrive at that moment here. Who do you believe? I think the longer this thing wears on, it's more and more difficult to determine. We want to believe the evidence of our own eyes, but okay, now we're on day 25. How many times have you seen that same shell stuck in that same piece of ground? If we were having massive war every day, shouldn't there be new footage somewhere?
Well, they did it today with the Mariupol or wherever that the port city is. They're basically now drawing back to like Dresden in Germany, and that it's been leveled, it's in ruins, it's completely encircled. You know, and again, the assets we have for explaining these things are so limited. In some ways, they're old. Like we had Vietnam, but none of that war rhetoric really seems to fit here. So we're going all the way back to 40s Europe to grab assets for ways to talk about what's happening with Putin.
Right, but look at how each of those images fits into a context of talk, of you know, metaphors, analogies to Dresden, to other destruction, whereas you are being shown the same burned down apartment. I'm not saying all of that stuff isn't going on. I'm not saying it isn't horrible. I'm saying we really don't know what counts as information. Or not
at all.
What? Right.
Well, and you even
information we have to act on.
Well, you even said the phrase, you know, you can't believe your own eyes. Those are not your eyes.
Right.
Those are somebody else's eyes have grabbed a photo and shown you one photo out of what are literally billions of images that are happening right now in the Ukraine. So there is no direct access to the information, to the, you know, reality on the ground. So when you expect people to reach logical conclusions from this tiny myopic one picture versus the whole of what's happening in that country right now, that's insanity to expect rational conclusions.
Sure. And so, and once again, these things yield to different opposing interpretations. One of the, and it sounds smart when it's getting said, and it sounds true when it's getting said. Well, let's not confuse winning, right? We shouldn't say that we're winning, right? Because even though factually, the Soviet, or the Soviet, the Russian troops have not advanced much, that doesn't mean that victory. What it does seem to mean is that the aerial bombardment is ratcheted up. But then the Atlantic, which I think is one of the more respectable journals this morning, publishes an article, Why We're Winning. So once again, you really don't know. At least I don't.
So what does rhetoric do in this situation when it's an overwhelming scenario, landscape of information, disinformation, partial imagery? What does rhetoric come in and say, hey, we've got some things here that can help? Let's pull back from the whole landscape a little bit and let's look at, you know, something like story that's being constructed. Because it is just in process. It hasn't landed yet on like which of those frames is going to be dominant, you know?
Right. Well, and both stay alive until we look back, right? This is the other, you mentioned earlier the turn toward history. When did an article appears? Well, the Ukraine really was the first acquisition of what was the emerging. So somebody's one-upping Putin's sense of history that it was always been part of Russia. Well, if you go back far enough, it was the first acquisition of empire here. Oh, well, that makes it right.
Do you stop the history?
So, and all of these, you know, so history becomes plastic in that sense of that we will call out whichever historical narrative best suits our rhetorical purposes. So rhetoric's going to do what rhetoric does, and we've identified all of those things. I suppose about the only thing the consumer can do is try to be, you know, appropriately skeptical without being dismissive, right? I think skepticism has kind of warped itself, you know, when you get, you know, the QAnon guys saying I'm doing my own research, or the standard person saying, well, you can't believe anything that anybody says. So I think. You know, one has to be appropriately skeptical in trying to ask what's not settled about this message. What are the claims of truth? So just sort of unraveling, I guess, the construction of that message. Does that, you know, I think we've arrived at this moment. War, once again, contracts the framework ultimately to action or not action. Where ultimately you could be paralyzed by that and not be able to do anything. You know, when it comes down to getting killed with the guns pointed at you, it doesn't matter.
Well, yeah. What do you say to the guy who's got the gun pointed at you to stop him from, you know, pulling the trigger?
You know? what they've been saying in the movies, like it's a heavy bombardment, right? You don't have to do this.
Yeah, like in No Country for Old Men.
Right, you don't have to do this.
Like, why does everybody always say that? Like, well, that's the only rhetoric, you know, that they've got. And I guess if we were being rhetoricians, we would give them new things to say.
Let's try some multiple interpretive options here.
So what do we say? Like, we have you and I have an hour with Putin. What do we say as rhetoricians to him?
Oh, that's I think I almost throw into, well, I think he is beyond rhetoric at that point. Right?
I don't know. Like it's easy to be at a distance and see that again as he's been filtered through, but he's been in power there for an awfully long time. Sure. He can't be completely insane. He's got to have some rationality still, you know, to be able to process things. He's not walking around in a diaper at his public events.
I think maybe you as the comedian have the answer. I think there is no political advisorly in the realm of threat kind of all of the sober options strike me as pointless, but maybe just start humoring him somehow, right?
I don't know. Look at the traditional
creating humor out of it. I don't know.
Like, we go back to, you know, the software itself, and that's why I wrote the book, The 21 Colosseums.
Right.
Let's just go through the menu and see what might work with him. Would inducements, you know, rewards versus costs, do anything? Or are there anything that he does value that we could offer? And you hear the psychological explanations for this, like he needs to feel like he won, or he can't be shamed, he can't be made to look small, he's got to have the authoritarian psyche. Is that what we need to offer him? Like, hey, we've come up with a way for you to, you know, actually raise your esteem here. Is that what he's after? Or is there material things that he's actually after? And what I would say is, like, to start, just let's break him apart in the menu and say, okay, let's design. This is going to be a difficult hour of rhetoric, so we're going to have to hyper design it. Let's see what we got for this guy.
So this is sounding like an intervention to me.
Right.
I think I heard Seth Meyers being interviewed about doing an interview for John Maloney, intervention recently. And so it had that really, we need a group of people here, each of whom will write out a short statement.
Yeah, which is it's a psychological strategy, right? It's right. You get a group, so you have multiple points of attack, and they're all going at different elements of your psyche, so that they can get through your armor and reach the psychological human again. Which, you know, I as a rhetorical strategy, they're probably worse approaches.
Worth a shot to see if one can access his humanity. I mean, to see, you know. I suppose that is kind of what sort of was hoped for, that when people say things like, well, gee, when enough body bags come home, the mothers will intervene as they have in the past, and this will have enough symbolic cachet, I guess. I don't know.
He's not going to arrest all the mothers, is that it?
Right. I don't know. I guess we will find out whether that's, you know, whether he is really completely deranged or without human empathy or not. It's really very difficult to, you know, I mean, that's the way we are characterizing his mode of warfare. More and more as I watch this, it strikes me just as he's conducting war as though he were playing Risk on the game board, right? Just stack up your armies all around and continue to roll against. And if you've ever played Risk, right, you know, the Ukraine is right there. Yeah. If you're going to move Europe one way or the other. But that to me is kind of the astonishing thing, is how contained this is into World War II technology. Mm-hmm. And maybe it'll creep out of that somehow. We're talking about hacking. We're talking about, you know, nuclear missiles. We're talking about chemical warfare. I think that's the, there's a kind of a strange containment of a number of ways here. And I think that's just it, is that we don't know. We don't really know what the consequences of that are. The current question, well, what do we do if he does one of these things? Nobody wants to say.
Right. Well, so. That's the story that they were so big in the 70s and 80s, like with war games and all the nuke stories and all the, you know, all the Armageddon stories and dystopias that sort of fall out of a nuclear war. But in some ways that has been put away for the last 20 or 30 years. And I think you're right. Like, we're just going back and using the story architecture from like tanks and the 40s, like the World War II. But, and it's not like the hypersonic thing is new. I remember this coming up a year or two ago when he, you know, announced that we have hypersonic missiles that can go anywhere and you can't shoot them down.
Right.
I was like, that sounds like a problem. And now if he's starting to use those things again, like, there's no story architecture for that. Those have never been used.
Right.
And nukes and atomic weapons have only been used once, right, by us. So there's no real story frame for that. So are we just going to allow, first you got to allow the organic. See, that's my thing about, you know, the whole rhetoric creates reality. I'm like, organic language creates reality. like it just roils until everybody's like, okay, I think we have a position here. Let's all try to use that. Rhetoric comes in and tries to alter it maybe, but like, you know, with this idea of hypersonics and nuclear weapons, like the organic war structures, war stories haven't fallen out yet because these things haven't actually happened. So it's all imagination.
That's nice.
How do you make people scared of it? You know, or how do we say like, this is the real thing here. Like we may have to sacrifice Ukraine, which is one of the things
that does seem to be kind of what's going on at the moment. At least that is sort of the Ukrainians' position. Hey, wait a minute. we're taking this hit for you, right?
Yeah, and Zelensky has said this, especially recently, that this will become a wider war if you let him take us. Like he's not stopping.
Well, and that is interesting to me. I mean that because that seems to be the rhetorical, if that's the right word, the interpretive ambiguity here about where is the line that gets crossed, right? And that's kind of that's what everybody's searching for. Where is that line? And one way to deal with
okay, we lost a little bit there. We're going to go back. The internet. The Russians are messing with our internet, man. They're trying to take us down.
Could be. This podcast is one of their more severe threats, I'm sure.
But, well, you know, I, rhetoricians are never allowed into the actual rooms of power. But if we could get an hour and it was a hyper-designed hour, maybe we could have some little effect on Putin.
There you go. Well, once again, what I was talking about was that the sort of the ambiguity right now in terms of moving from verbiage to action has to do with where's the line that gets crossed. And so everybody's kind of looking toward these, as you were articulating, these imaginistic, at least, events of the future. If that happens, is that the line? If this is escalated in somehow outside the frame that it's being contained in. So I've seen lots of containment strategies, but then at the same time growing up and dismissed as well, maybe that line has already been crossed. And sort of the backward looking, now let's reorganize history here. We've really underestimated Putin since 2008 was a phrase that I heard. Well, I don't know. When he took Crimea, I guess is the reference. That was 2014, right? In 2008, I remember what was going. We had world recession. We had tremendous political paralysis in the United States. I don't know what we would have been doing at that time. In 2014, when Crimea came along, has America really had? Was this a matter of underestimating him? Because at the same time, I think the argument is getting made that, well, we overestimate his abilities. Look at, you know.
Yeah.
So we're both underestimating and overestimating, each of which has to sort of find some sort of proportionality, I guess, in terms of justifications for war. So maybe that's the file to open up here is these are all justifications for war. That we're kind of sorting for. And I guess that's what concerns me in the aggregate is that is really what all of this talk amounts to.
Well, and ultimately
there isn't really a big file right now called reasons not to go to war. Right.
Yeah.
So I think it takes on a certain amount of inevitability. And for that reason, I think maybe some people, and I am essentially a pacifist, would want to say, gee, the media coverage has all conspired without necessarily intending to continue to carry us along that path.
Well, and that's the most active storyline always. I remember just in Gone with the Wind, remember Rhett Butler standing around while all the Southerners were saying, yeah, war, it's going to be over in a week. Well, and he's like, yeah, have you been up there? Have you actually, right. You know, and this sense of rush to war and the activism of war. And that's got a clear rhetoric. Like it's got a clear, like you said, it's the reasons for war are fairly clear and you haven't seen a ton of it yet, but horrificness and, you know, widespread death and cruelty and chemical weapons and nuclear weapons, all these things become reasons within that narrative for war. The reasons not for war, I think, you know, we've talked about it a little bit, the whole nuclear end of humanity would probably be, you know, a big one.
High on my list, yes.
Yeah. And so I think that's an important thing to define. Like maybe that's one of the things rhetoricians should be able to lay out. Let's lay out all your reasons for war, all your reasons against war. And now we can at least have a discussion that's organized intellectually within the hyper ambiguous, chaotic war environment. And that never seems to happen. Nobody's really going meta on the war in this situation, right? Nobody in the media ever really goes meta.
And what would that look like? What would going meta look like?
Well, just a list, like even just the start of, hey, let's look at rationality, the claims of, like I do this with clients when I do rhetorical or persuasion design for businesses. I'm like, let's create a persuasion tree. And on the left is all the reasons why somebody would buy your stuff. And on the right is all the reasons why people would not buy your stuff. And our job in the messaging is to shear off every branch on the right and put Christmas ornaments on every branch on the left. And until you're done with that, you haven't really answered all the things that are keeping people from buying from you. So if we could look at that as a war exercise the same way, reasons not to go to war, reasons to go to war, let's see what we can do here. It'd probably be two separate trees, but.
Right. Well, I think, that's nice, except you know which side of the tree you really want to nurture in the case of sales. And so if indeed your propagandistic goal were to either get us out of the war or get us into it, you would know fairly clearly which side. I think the problem is being stuck in the middle.
Right. You have to build both trees, and then you can, but at some point you've got to make a decision, and decision paralysis happens, I think, like when you do have, you're sitting in the middle, but you've got vague awareness of both sides. Like having explicit awareness at least allows you to, you know, get out of that sort of hyper dense, I can't really see the possible answers.
Sure.
I end up doing a lot of this for people, of adding hyper clarity to their decisions, because they haven't even looked at all the different reasons yet. They can't see them.
So going meta basically is to step back and look at this as a decision that is, because I think that's what we're not doing. Nobody's sort of saying, gee, we keep talking toward a hypothetical decision that seems to be sort of a ghost of this discourse. Mm-hmm. So the Sasquatch of the right
decision out
stomping
here.
Through the forest of statements of reports, images, and interpretations. Nobody's seen it very clearly here. So going meta would be a matter of sort of saying, well, ultimately, and maybe there are think tanks and people in the Pentagon for whom this is their business. I hope so, right?
Yeah, I hope so too.
We hope there are people who thought about this in this way, that ultimately a decision.
It's like we're getting a little funky again on our internet. All right. Well, we're on an unstable internet connection, so we're going to keep trying, keep going. All right. So you were going on hoping the Pentagon has this under lock.
there are people who study as, the decision to make war. And that seems to be kind of the moment, which is, all right, here is currently the policy very, very clear about we're not going to be directly making contact. And people trying to find all the fudging, I suppose, possible in that line, or can we, how well do we budge that line one way or another in terms of military support, military equipment? And once again, I suppose that has to be some sort of cooperative model with Putin too. When, how does he interpret these particular moves of the frameworks that they have? I know my examples always date me, but I recall, talking about the history and narrative, but that, I think history could happen. Unfortunately, we have a history of wars, which is always going to privilege. And that's why, we didn't stop Hitler. We should have, be stopping, right? He will keep going, this narrative of inevitability that what he really wants is total, world domination. And at some point, we're going to have to fight it, that kind of thing. I used to talk about this in terms of, right, these sort of moral discourses in the media, and once again, my examples date me terribly, but one was the original Star Trek that had the prime directive to never interfere in the affairs of another planet. Yet virtually every week they interfered in the affairs of another planet.
Right.
So what it becomes is an elaborate moral sorking, right? The drama is, what are the reasons to do so? And you can kind of then read the ideology by looking at the reasons they give to interfere. This culture is stagnant. This culture is oppressive. This culture doesn't align itself, which becomes then a kind of a statement of our 60s foreign policy, why we're in Vietnam, which was happening during the same years. The other example that I always used terribly was Kung Fu. Here's a guy who doesn't want to have any violence whatsoever, yet he engages in a violent confrontation every week. So what we learn from the drama is, what are the moral reasons for engaging in a violent confrontation? And so this turn to history becomes similar to these episodes. The mythology of history then becomes the meta model for, what are the reasons that we do so? What are the moral justifications for engaging this war?
Yeah, and a lot of it becomes moral fishing. Like, we just keep pulling up this. How about this one? No, not enough. How about this one? No, not enough. Chemical use on your own people. So like,
well, until you've heard all of those precedents cited. Well, we did in Iraq, because of chemical warfare. Well, we did. Yeah. So that once again, there is a kind of an inventional tree for this rhetoric that we're seeing played out over and over again. As we sort of move this big ball along.
Well, and it is interesting too, like where we're sitting now with the history, going back and poaching again and again, trying to find our moral reasons and our analogies in the historical wars, but also now sitting here in a new war situation, which has new weapons, new outcomes, new things that have never been, potentially sitting there before. So we are missing narratives. Like, we have not built these narratives yet. And to me, that becomes really problematic in that now people don't know what to fear, and then they start fearing the imagination, the science fiction. They start using science fiction stories for the future scenarios because that's all they've got.
Right. And I've actually heard, I think, Heinlein invoked in this kind of, because he wrote, this sort of libertarian mythology of war for the future, right? So I thought, wow, that makes me shudder. Good reading as an adolescent, but scary policy.
Well, and I guess like Terminator, I'm trying to think of the dystopian movies that are sitting there to keep people from wanting to engage Putin. Trying to think of what's been grabbed so far from the zeitgeist of stories that we have,
Schwarzenegger menu. certainly brought the Terminator thing to the fore.
Well, maybe that's the problem. Putin thinks of himself as this automaton, and he's using that story of, I cannot care about others and create the empire that is Soviet Russia again. Right. Was there ever any explanation? I don't remember back, like, for why the Soviet Union actually broke up in the first place. Like, all of a sudden, just the wall fell and like, oh, it was because of Reagan. I'm like, no, it wasn't. What's the real reason that Gorbachev gave up this and then the war and the wall fell?
Right. Well, I don't, you know, I wish I were the historian to tell you, and I'm sure it's like most of these events in history, you'll probably find somebody to represent. I know what got sold to us in the Reagan era at the time very much was to give Reagan credit for this, or to give the American policy of Cold War credit for this, that basically we our policy of spending, you know, all of our income, all of our wealth on military, that because trying to compete with that is what ruined the Soviet Union. However, I heard Gorbachev interviewed years later. He said, that's just ridiculous. He said, we could have continued to do that indefinitely. That really isn't the problem whatsoever. So I happen to believe him because he seemed like such a reasonable guy when it came down to it.
Well, what did he say? What did he say, like, why he gave it? They split it up.
I think it's just I don't recall exactly, but I think it was more the internal pressures in the Soviet alliances themselves, that it's not going to withstand openness, that there were these regional ethnic groups that didn't want to be part of the Soviet Union, that the oppressiveness of the communist stranglehold basically wore thin. It could have been, you know, and probably was bolstered by economic strife, that when the empire isn't doing what empire is supposed to do for you, it starts rupturing at the seams. So why do empires end? Why do people decide that it's in their better interest to not participate, to resist?
Well, have you tracked this stuff where I've read off and on in places that is why the oligarchs allowed that to happen in Russia, because it let them out. It wasn't to let the West in and bring the wall down. It's that once the wall came down and the Soviet Union broke up, the oligarchs could now go out into the world and they could propagate their stuff. They could own things outside. Like it was a move to open up the economy of the super rich.
Right. And I don't know the trajectory of the oligarchy from that era to the current era. I think there's, you know, that's not one continuous. I would have to think that under the Soviet Union and communist rule, I'm not saying there weren't oligarchs, but the what's happened since then in terms of basically what has been likened to a criminal state or bandit capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe the more salient question is, how does that feed into where we're at right now, with oligarchs having their money outside of Russia, having their interest and their lifestyles outside of Russia, apparently having stolen a great deal of the budget that was supposed to be spent on the military for themselves. And I don't think we don't have that storied very well yet. I don't think we understand, you know, in our ordinary discourse, what Russia really has been doing, or the role of the oligarchs in the power that exists. One thing I have read is that basically since Putin took over Crimea in 2014, that their economy has suffered because we put sanctions in place for whatever set of reasons, you know, whether that is the only reason or there are other reasons, I wouldn't know. But if you read Putin's moves here in light of a failed economy and growing unrest, division, generational change, disaffection of the power structure, the oligarchy that he put into place, then, you know, it sort of makes sense that maybe this is kind of his ghost dance of the Soviet Union.
Well, and it's a similar move that, like, the Bush-Cheney, you know, let's invade Iraq and, you know, move. We need a war. Like, you don't have Blackwaters and Halliburtons don't make money, you know, unless there's a war. We need to get rid of this stuff in order to refresh the armaments. There is that sense of, and again, this is where we start running these parallel narratives. I think the narrative that we don't have as Americans, it's not nearly as developed as our other narratives, is the financial narrative about all this. What is the financial story behind this war that's accurate enough that people are like, yes, that's why the financial things are you know, the financial story of the war versus like that, which is the power, you know, the corporate entities need to replenish. They need to have wars in order to, you know, restock their supply and things like that.
Well, we don't even have a believable narrative about America's interests in the Ukraine in the last 6 years or what the hell Trump was up to in any of these events with our relationships with Russia. So I think, you know, once again, there's this sort of sorting out, and we've got these different voices on the Republican side, what John Bolton thought was going on and what, you know, was really going on and what, you know, Putin was telling Trump was going on. And once again, it's all sort of wrecked on the, you know, whatever truth might be there is sort of washed on the shore or whatever, as Trump himself mutates in relationship to this crisis. So,
well, it reminds me of what happened with The Big Short. Remember that movie?
I do.
We had this very complicated 2008 crash. Nobody understood what had happened. And then The Big Short comes along and it's like, hey, I think I'm going to maybe try to treat this narratively in a way that people could sort of follow. And you could kind of sort of follow it. They were very careful to take you through piece by piece and give you some characters to follow. And like, there's nothing I can think of that has done that with the financial complications of war. I mean, you have the Born on 4th July, you have the platoons, you have, you know, these big things like that.
Sure, yeah, the ideological battle, but not the material battle. Sure, I think that's a good point. Is that charting the economic history of Vietnam is, like I said, there may be scholars out there that have done it, but I remember when I was in college, a radical book came out that tried to really use economic data to talk about slavery. And it was a huge revelation in history. It was very controversial because you had almost 200 years of, or over 100 years of history about the Civil War written through the lenses of Southern sympathizers and Northern, you know, generals or whatever. And to really look at the material circumstances under which all of this took place was, you know, bubble bursting. So maybe, you're right. I mean, that's just sort of a commentary about the mythology of war itself. What we understand about Vietnam was largely rendered through films. And we notice we don't get Vietnam films until 10 years after the Vietnam War. And you get a whole spate of them, right? Apocalypse Now and Platoon and, you know, whatever. Full Metal Jacket. But there's almost a whole lag there. And I noticed that then because I looked at that, people looking at that genre of film about Vietnam, we still don't have very many films about the Iraq War. There's a few, but it doesn't really take on very much the issues of the war itself any more than Whisky Tango Foxtrot takes on what was going on in Afghanistan, but exists almost singularly as any kind of treatment of those circumstances. So, right. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's, again, the role of the rhetorician slash artist is starting to bring some of these things to the public in a way that they can consume within story and complicate, you know, these narratives so that we aren't rushing to war based on the moral and the tragic and, you know, the things that we have typically done. You heard a lot of this vague criticism. And again, it comes back on both sides in weird ways about, it's just corporations. This is still just corporations, you know, and we're going to fight for Shell Oil in Vietnam and things like that. So it's, you've heard those criticisms in vague ways, but it's never detailed, and especially not in a story, you know?
Well, sure. And to say it's all about oil, I mean, that became the cliche thing to say about Iraq. And I don't think people really understood what that meant. Certainly that was a factor, right? Invading Kuwait, Halliburton.
Well, and the Dick gas Cheney. Pipeline, clearly the natural gas through. Pipeline through Germany and Russia. That was the first thing that started this. The first explanation that came out that was sort of a financial explanation is, Putin needs to be able to get his gas to the port,
right,
and he
right.
doesn't want to deal with Ukraine and, you know, Europe.
Yeah, that's pretty much spy novel I think we've sort of stumbled upon this sort of, you know, we basically have what I've considered these languages of human events: history, rhetoric, journalism, literature, / film. That give us the ways that we talk about, right, what happens and process what happens, and they're all, you know, plastic. They're all narrative interpretations. So we may not know for quite a while.
Yeah, but are we?
I don't think people really have much sense as we look at the current oil prices and the talk around it. I think people believe, and the market acts as though supply and demand were the only factors. When indeed, you know, that, oh, we must have this, you know, Russian oil, and that's why we don't have price. You know,
yeah,
why prices have gone up. And I suppose there's a lot of investment in people not really understanding or knowing the truth about any of that.
Well, it lets you get away with a lot more when, you know, you're under the cover of confusion and non-access. So the question becomes, like, which narrative track are we going to bobsled down, you know, and which ones are going to hit like a brick wall here, and which one's just going to flow right through, and like, there we go. That's the narrative of the Ukraine. And I think Zelensky's been fighting to keep people on his narrative track and has done a good job with it. The question is, like, are these, you know, what's going to happen with him as it goes forward if he's taken out? If the story changes, like, how much control do we have? Can we at least see the options of the tracks? And I think that's where rhetoric sits to start, is like, I can at least lay out the tracks that are being offered to you cleanly. And they are being constructed through language. And maybe Putin doesn't have a track. And maybe we just don't see the track that he's going down because it hasn't been laid out for us yet.
Well, I'm starting to see talk sort of put that together, that, gee, this is why China wants to be buddy-buddy here.
Yeah, suddenly China flows into
In terms of some sort of macro global perspective, this is part of the diminishment of the West, that this unifying of Russia and China. I guess my only problem with that, as I hardly an expert, but I just don't see that China really needs Russia except for oil, our resources. I don't see it. That's too asymmetrical, as far as I can see.
And, well, unless they're going to be the proxy war for China, you know, like,
I mean, it is a huge amount of land mass, but once again, I don't think we're playing risk anymore. I don't think it's all about just, yeah. So
it's still
that
up
is
in the
one,
air.
That is one set of options out there, I suppose.
I think we'll keep fighting our way through it. We didn't do any of the Supreme Court stuff today, even though we previewed that. We'll have to circle back around maybe and do a Supreme Court.
We'll know more next week. We only have a few hours of a grueling questioning at this point in time.
A few hours of bad.
There were a few
Kabuki
interesting
theater
moments as I watched it, but
it's crazy. We'll talk about it next week. So, again, the whole idea here, I think, for rhetoric is do what you do, rhetoric. Try to clean this up as much as we can so people can think their way through it and that we can tell better stories so we capture enough of the minds that it goes into the channel that we want. I don't know what the problem is right now. I don't even know what I want. Like, I don't know what to want here other than, hey, let's not blow everybody up. Ukraine seems like a better place than Russia, so I want Ukraine to win. But those are very, you know, big amorphous judgments based on almost nothing, which, you know, is not great for a rhetorician.
I just don't see that changing. I don't see any way back to make them not the good guys and getting the bad guys. But
not even if Madison Cawthorn sits there and, you know, says that Zelensky's a thug and everybody's stealing, you know, the whole corrupt government, very weird narrative in the middle of all this from a American politician. But
I only have one goal, and that's for Tucker Carlson to emerge embarrassed.
that would be a victory for sure. Well, all right, man, thanks again. Thanks for jumping on. We will come back again next time, talk about the Supreme Court, and I'm sure we'll keep talking about the war as well. This is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Thanks again, Dr. Dave Payne. Get out there, persuade people, somebody figure out the war. and tell us what to believe, because I think that would be helpful. All right. See you next time.